Dickens, girl. Walder Frey. Any of three, he said. Has he wed? Anyone? Anyone?
No one, Catlin said. Yet he has come many leagues to see you, fighting his way back to River Run. I would not be here now if Sir Brynden had not helped us.
He was ever a warrior,
her father husked.
That he could do. Knights of the Geat, yes.
He leaned back and closed his eyes, inutterably weary.
Send him later. I'll sleep now. Too sick to fight. Send him up later. The Blackfish.
Catlin kissed him gently, smoothed his hair, and left him there, in the shade of his keep, with his rivers flowing beneath. He was asleep before she left the Solar. When she returned to the Lower Bailey, Sir Brynden Tully stood on the water stair with wet boots, talking with the captain of River Run's guards. He came to her at once. Is he... Dying, she said, as we feared. Her uncle's craggy face showed his pain, plain. He ran his fingers through his thick grey hair. Will he see me? She nodded. He says he is too sick to fight. Brynden Blackfish chuckled.
I'm too old a soldier to believe that. Huster will be chiding me about that red wine girl, even as we light his funeral pyre, damn his bones.
Catlin smiled, knowing it was true. I do not see Rob. He went with Greyjoy to the hall, I believe. Theon Greyjoy was seated on a bench in River Run's great hall, enjoying a horn of ale and regaling her father's garrison with an account of the slaughter in the Whispering Woods.
Some tried to flee, but we pinched the valley shot at both ends, and we rode out of the darkness with sword and lance. The Lannisters must have thought the others themselves were on them when that wolf of Rob's got in among them. I saw him tear one man's arm from his shoulder, and their horses went mad at the scent of him. I couldn't tell you how many men were thrown.
Theon, she interrupted, where might I find my son?
Lord Rob went to visit the Godswood, milady.
It was what Ned would have done. He is his father's son, as much as mine, I must remember.
Oh, gods, Ned!
She found Rob beneath a green canopy of leaves, surrounded by tall redwoods and great old elms, kneeling before the heart tree. A slender weirwood, with a face more sad than fierce. His long sword was before him, the point thrust in the earth, his gloved hands clasped around the hilt. Around him others knelt. Grey John Umber, Rickard Carstark, Mage Mormont, Galbert Glover, and more. Even Titus Blackwood was among them. The great raven cloak fanned out behind him. These are the ones who keep the old guards, she realized. She asked herself what guards she kept these days, and could not find an answer. It would not do to disturb them at their prayers. The guards must have their due, even cruel guards who would take Ned from her, and her lord father as well. So Catlin waited. The river wind moved through the high branches, and she could see the wheel tower to her right, ivy crawling up its side. As she stood there, all the memories came flooding back to her. Her father had taught her to ride among these trees, and that was the elm that Edmure had fallen from when he broke his arm. And over there, beneath that bower, she and Lysa had played at kissing with Pataya. She had not thought of that in years. How young they had all been. She no older than Sansa, Lysa younger than Arya, and Pataya younger still, yet eager. The girls had traded him between them, serious and giggling by turns. It came back to her so vividly she could almost feel his sweaty fingers on her shoulders and taste the mint on his breath. There was always mint growing in the Godswood, and Bataar had liked to chew it. He'd been such a bold little boy, always in trouble.
"He tried to put his tongue in my mouth," Catelyn had confessed to her sister afterwards, when they were alone. "He did it with me, too," Lysa had whispered, shy and breathless. "I liked it."
Rub got to his feet slowly and sheathed his sword, and Catelyn found herself wondering whether her son had ever kissed a girl in the God's Wood. Surely he must have. She had seen Jane Poole giving him moist-eyed glances, and some of the serving girls, even ones as old as 18. He had ridden in battle and killed men with a sword. Surely he had been kissed. There were tears in her eyes. She wiped them away, angrily.
"Mother," Rub said when he saw her standing there, "we must call a council. There are things to be decided."
"Your grandfather would like to see you," she said. "Rub, he's very sick."
"Sir Edmure, tell me. I'm sorry, Mother, for Lord Huster and for you, yet first we must meet. We've had word from the south. Renly Baratheon has claimed his brother's crown."
"Renly?" she said, shocked. "I had thought, surely it would be Lord Stannis."
"So did we all, my lady," Galbert Glover said.
The war council convened in the great hall, at four long trestle tables arranged in a broken square. Lord Huster was too weak to attend, asleep on his balcony, dreaming of the sun on the rivers of his youth. Edmure sat in the high seat of the Tullys, with Brynden Blackfish at his side, and his father's bannermen arrayed to right and left and along the side tables. Word of the victory at River Run had spread to the fugitive lords of the Trident, drawing them back. Carol Vance came in, a lord now, his father dead beneath the Golden Tooth. Sir Mark Piper was with him, and they brought a Derry, Sir Raymond's son, a lad no older than Bran. Lord Jonas Bracken arrived from the ruins of Stonehenge, glowering and blustering, and took a seat as far from Titus Blackwood as the tables would permit. The northern lord sat opposite, with Catelyn and Rob facing her brother across the tables. They were fewer. The great John sat at Rob's left hand, and then Theon Greyjoy, Galbert Glover, and Lady Mormont were to the right of Catelyn. Lord Rickard Carstark, gaunt and hollow-eyed in his grief, took his seat like a man in a nightmare, his long beard uncombed and unwashed. He had left two sons dead in the Whispering Wood, and there was no word of the third, his eldest, who had led the Carstark's peers against Tywin Lannister on the Green Fork. The arguing raged on late into the night. Each lord had a right to speak, and speak they did, and shout, and curse, and reason, and cajole, and jest, and bargain, and slam tankards on the table, and threaten, and walk out, and return sullen or smiling. Catelyn sat and listened to it all. Roose Bolton had reformed the battered remnants of their other host at the mouth of the causeway. Sir Helmund Tallheart and Walder Frey still held the twins. Lord Tywin's army had crossed the Trident and was making for Harrenhal, and there were two kings in the realm. Two kings and no agreement. Many of the lord's bannermen wanted to march on Harrenhal at once, to meet Lord Tywin and end Lannister power for all time. Young, hot-tempered Mark Piper urged the strike west, at Casterly Rock instead. Still others counseled patience. River Run sat athwart the Lannister supply lines, Jason Mallister pointed out. Let them bide their time, denying Lord Tywin fresh levies and provisions while they strengthened their defences and rested their weary troops. Lord Blackwood would have none of it. They should finish the work they began in the Whispering Wood, march to Harrenhal, and bring Roose Bolton's army down as well. What Blackwood urged, Bracken opposed, as ever. Lord Jonas Bracken rose to insist they ought to pledge their fealty to King Renly, and move south to join their might to his. "Renly is not the king," Rob said. It was the first time her son had spoken. Like his father, he knew how to listen. "You cannot mean to hold to Joffrey, my lord," Galbert Glover said. "He put your father to death." "That makes him evil," Rob replied. "I do not know that it makes Renly king. Joffrey is still Robert's eldest true-born son, so the throne is rightfully his by all the laws of the realm. Were he to die, and I mean to see that he does, he has a younger brother. Tommen is next in line after Joffrey." "Tommen is no less a Lannister," Sir Mark Piper snapped. "As you say," said Rob, troubled. "Yet if neither one is king, still how could it be Lord Renly? He's Robert's younger brother. Bran can't be Lord of Winterfell before me, and Renly can't be king before Lord Stannis." Lady Mormont agreed.
"Lord Stannis has the better claim."
"Renly is crowned," said Mark Piper. "Highgarden and Storm's End support his claim, and the Dornishmen will not be laggardly. If Winterfell and Riverrun add their strength to his, he will have 5 of the 7 great houses behind him. 6, if the Aerons bestir themselves. 6 against the Rock. My lords, within the year, we will have all their heads on pikes, the Queen and the Boy King, Lord Tywin the Imp, the Kingslayer, Sir Kevin, all of them. That is what we shall win if we join with King Renly. What does Lord Stannis have against that, that we should cast it all aside?"
"The right," said Rob stubbornly. Catelyn thought he sounded eerily like his father as he said it.
"So you mean us to declare for Stannis?" said Edmure.
"I don't know," said Rob. "I prayed to know what to do, but the gods did not answer. The Lannisters killed my father for a traitor, and we know that was a lie. But if Joffrey is the lawful king, and we fight against him, we will be traitors."
"My lord father would urge caution," aged Sir Stevron said, with a weaselly smile of a fray.
"Wait, let these two kings play their game of thrones. When they are done fighting, we shall bend our knee to the victor or oppose him, as we choose. With Renly arming, likely Lord Tywin would welcome a truce, and the safe return of his son. Noble lords, allow me to go to him to Harrenhal and arrange good terms and ransoms."
A roar of outrage drowned out his voice.
"Craven!"
the Great John thundered.
"Begging for a truce will make us seem weak," declared Lady Mormont.
"Ransoms be damned, we must not give up the Kingslayer," shouted Rickard Carstock.
"Why not a peace?" Catelyn asked. The lords looked at her. But it was Rob's eyes she felt, his and his alone. "My lady, they murdered my lord father, your husband," he said grimly. He unsheathed his longsword and laid it on the table before him, the bright steel on the rough wood. "This is the only peace I have for Lannisters." The Great John bellowed his approval, and other men added their voices, shouting and drawing swords and pounding their fists on the table. Catelyn waited until they had quieted. "My lords," she said then, "Lord Eddard was your liege, but I shared his bed. I bore his children. Do you think I love him any less than you?" Her voice almost broke with her grief. But Catelyn took a long breath and steadied herself. "Rob, if that sword could bring him back, I should never let you sheathe it until Ned stood at my side once more. But he is gone, and 100 Whispering Woods will not change that. Ned is gone. And Darren Hornwood, and Lord Carstock's valiant sons, and many other good men besides. And none of them will return to us. Must we have more death still?"
"You are a woman, my lady," the Great John rumbled in his deep voice. "Women do not understand these things."
"You are the gentle sex," said Lord Carstock, with the lines of grief fresh on his face. "A man has a need for vengeance." Give me Cersei Lannister, Lord Carstark, and you would see how gentle a woman can be, Catelyn replied. Perhaps I do not understand tactics and strategy, but I understand futility. We went to war when Lannister armies were ravaging the Riverlands, and Ned was a prisoner, falsely accused of treason. We fought to defend ourselves and to win my lord's freedom. Well, the one is done, and the other forever beyond our reach. I will mourn for Ned until the end of my days, but I must think of the living. I want my daughters back, and the queen holds them still. If I must trade our four Lannisters for their two Starks, I will call that a bargain and thank the gods. I want you safe, Rob, ruling at Winterfell from your father's seat. I want you to live your life to kiss a girl and wed a woman and father a son. I want to write an end to this. I want to go home, my lords, and weep for my husband. The hall was very quiet when Catelyn finished speaking.
Peace, said her uncle Brynden. Peace is sweet, my lady, but on what terms? It's no good hammering your sword into a ploughshare if you must forge it again on the morrow.
What did Turin and my Eddard die for, if I am to return to Carhold with nothing but their bones? Asked Rickard Carstark.
I, said Lord Bracken, Gregor Clegane laid waste to my fields, slaughtered my small folk, and left Stonehenge a smoking ruin. Am I now to bend the knee to the ones who sent him? What have we fought for, if we are to put all back as it was before?
Lord Blackwood agreed, to Catelyn's surprise and dismay.
And if we do make peace with King Joffrey, are we not then traitorous to King Renly? What if the stag should prevail against the lion? Where would that leave us?
Whatever you may decide for yourselves, I shall never call a Lannister my king, declared Mark Piper.
Nor I, yelled the little Derry boy. I never will.
Again the shouting began. Catelyn sat despairing. She had come so close, she thought. They had almost listened. Almost. But the moment was gone. There would be no peace, no chance to heal, no safety. She looked at her son, watched him as he listened to the lord's debate, frowning, troubled, yet wedded to his war. He had pledged himself to marry a daughter of Walder Frey, but she saw his true bride plain before her now. The sword he had laid on the table. Catelyn was thinking of her girls, wondering if she would ever see them again, when the great John lurched to his feet.
"My lords," he shouted, his voice booming off the rafters. "Here is what I say to these two kings," he spat. "Renly Baratheon is nothing to me, nor Stannis neither. Why should they rule over me and mine from some flowery seat in Highgarden or Dorn? What do they know of the Wall or the Wolfswood, or the barrows of the first men? Even their guards are wrong. The others take the Lannisters, too. I've had a bellyful of them."
He reached back over his shoulder and drew his immense two-handed greatsword.
"Why shouldn't we rule ourselves again? It was the dragons we married, and the dragons are all dead."
He pointed at Rob with a blade.
"There sits the only king I mean to bow my knee to, my lords," he thundered. "The king in the north."
And he knelt and laid his sword at her son's feet.
"I'll have peace on those terms," Lord Carstark said. "They can keep their red castle and their iron chair as well."
He eased his long sword from its scabbard.
"The king in the north," he said, kneeling beside the great John.
Mage Mormont rose.
"The king of winter," she declared,
and laid her spike mace beside the swords. And the river lords were rising too, Blackwood and Bracken and Malister, houses who had never been ruled from Winterfell. Yet Catelyn watched them rise and draw their blades, bending their knees and shouting the old words that had not been heard in the realm for more than 300 years, since Aegon the Dragon had come to make the Seven Kingdoms one. yet now were heard again, ringing from the timbers of her father's hall. The king in the north! The king in the north! The king in the north! Daenerys. The land was red and dead and parched, and good wood was hard to come by. Her foragers returned with gnarled cottonwoods, purple brush, sheaves of brown grass. They took the two straightest trees, hacked the limbs and branches from them, skinned off their bark, and split them, laying the logs in a square. Its center they filled with straw, brush, bark shavings, and bundles of dry grass. Ricardo chose a stallion from the small herd that remained to them. He was not the equal of Khal Drogo's Red, but few horses were. In the center of the square, Aegor fed him a withered apple and dropped him in an instant with an axe blow between the eyes. Bound hand and foot, Miramar's Dor watched from the dust with disquiet in her black eyes.
"It's not enough to kill a horse," she told Danny. "By itself, the blood is nothing. You do not have the words to make a spell, nor the wisdom to feign them. Do you think blood magic is a game for children? You call me Meiji, as if it were a curse. But all it means is wise. You are a child with a child's ignorance. Whatever you mean to do, it will not work. Loose me from these bonds, and I will help you."
"I am tired of the Meiji's braying," Danny told Joga. He took his whip to her, and after that the god's wife kept silent. Over the carcass of the horse, they built a platform of hewn logs, trunks of smaller trees and limbs from the greater, and the thickest, straightest branches they could find. They laid the wood east to west from sunrise to sunset. On the platform they piled Khal Drogo's treasures, his great tent, his painted vests, his saddles and harness, the whip his father had given him when he came to manhood, the arrack he had used to slay Khal Ugo and his son, a mighty dragon-bone bow. Aegor would have added the weapons Drogo's blood riders had given Danny for bride gifts as well, but she forbade it. "Those are mine," she told them, "and I mean to keep them." Another layer of brush was piled about the Khal's treasures, and bundles of dried grass scattered over them. Sir Jorah Mormont drew her aside as the sun was creeping toward its zenith.
"Princess," he began.
"Why do you call me that?" Danny challenged him. "My brother Viserys was your king, was he not?"
"He was, my lady."
"Viserys is dead. I am his heir, the last blood of House Targaryen. Whatever was his is mine now."
"My queen," Sir Jorah said, going to one knee. "My sword that was his is yours, Daenerys, and my heart as well. That never belonged to your brother. I am only a knight, and I have nothing to offer you but exile. But I beg you, hear me. Let Khal Drogo go. You shall not be alone. I promise you no man shall take you to Vaes Dothrak unless you wish to go. You need not join the Doshkleen. Come east with me. Geaty, Kaas, the Jade Sea, Ashai by the Shadow. We will see all the wonders yet unseen, and drink what wines the gods see fit to serve us. Please, Khaleesi, I know what you intend. Do not. Do not."
"I must," Danny told him. She touched his face fondly, sadly. "You do not understand."
"Well, I understand that you loved him," Sir Jorah said in a voice thick with despair. "I loved my lady wife once, yet I did not die with her. You are my queen. My sword is yours, but do not ask me to stand aside as you climb on Drogo's pyre. I will not watch you burn."
"Is that what you fear?" Danny kissed him lightly on his broad forehead. "I am not such a child as that, sweet sir."
"You do not mean to die with him? You swear it, my queen?"
"I swear it," she said in the common tongue of the seven kingdoms that by rights were hers. The third level of the platform was woven of branches no thicker than a finger, and covered with dry leaves and twigs. They laid them north to south, from ice to fire, and piled them high with soft cushions and sleeping silks. The sun had begun to lower towards the west by the time they were done. Dany called the Dothraki around her. Fewer than 100 were left. How many had Aegon started with? She wondered. It did not matter. "You will be my Khalasar," she told them. "I see the faces of slaves. I free you. Take off your colors. Go if you wish. No one shall harm you. If you stay, it will be as brothers and sisters, husbands and wives." The black eyes watched her, wary, expressionless. "I see the children, women, the wrinkled faces of the aged. I was a child yesterday. Today I am a woman. Tomorrow I will be old. To each of you I say, give me your hands and your hearts, and there will always be a place for you." She turned to the three young warriors of her cars. "Jogo, to you I give the silver-handled whip that was my bride gift, and name you Ko, and ask your oath, that you will live and die as blood of my blood, riding at my side to keep me safe from harm." Jogo took the whip from her hands, but his face was confused.
"Khaleesi," he said hesitantly, "this is not done. It would shame me to be blood rider to a woman."
"Aegor," Dany called, paying no attention to Jogo's words,
"if I look back, I am lost."
"To you I give the dragonbone bow that was my bride gift. It was double-curved, shiny black, and exquisite, taller than she was. I name you Ko, and ask your oath that you should live and die as blood of my blood, riding at my side to keep me safe from harm." Aegor accepted the bow with lowered eyes.
"I cannot say these words. Only a man can lead a Khalasar or name a Ko."
"Rakharo," Dany said, turning away from the refusal, "you shall have the great Arrak that was my bride gift, with hilt and blade chased in gold. And you too I name my Ko, and ask you to live and die as blood of my blood, riding at my side to keep me safe from harm."
"You are Khaleesi," Rakharo said, taking the Arrak. "I shall ride at your side to Vaiz Dathrak, beneath the Mother of Mountains, and keep you safe from harm until you take your place with the crones of the Dushkaleen. No more can I promise."
She nodded, as calmly as if she had not heard his answer, and turned to the last of her champions. "Sir Jorah Mormont," she said, "first and greatest of my knights, I have no bride gift to give you, but I swear to you one day you shall have for my hands a long sword like none the world has ever seen, dragon-forged and made of Valyrian steel, and I would ask for your oath as well."
"You have it, my queen," Sir Jorah said, kneeling to lay his sword at her feet. "I vow to serve you, to obey you, and to die for you if need be."
"Whatever may come?"
"Whatever may come."
"I shall hold you to that oath. I pray you never regret the giving of it." Dany lifted him to his feet. Stretching on her toes to reach his lips, she kissed the knight gently and said, "You are the first of my queen's guard." She could feel the eyes of the Khalasar on her as she entered her tent. The Dothraki were muttering and giving her strange sideways looks from the corners of their dark almond eyes. They thought her mad, Dany realized. Perhaps she was. She would know soon enough. "If I look back, I am lost." Her bath was scalding hot when Iri helped her into the tub, but Dany did not flinch or cry aloud. She liked the heat. It made her feel clean.
Jiqui had scented the water with the oil she had found in the market in Vase Dothrak. The steam rose moist and fragrant. Doria washed her hair and combed it out, working loose the mats and tangles. Iri scrubbed her back. Danny closed her eyes and let the smell and the warmth enfold her. She could feel the heat soaking through the soreness between her thighs. She shuddered when it entered her, and her pain and stiffness seemed to dissolve. She floated. When she was clean, her handmaids helped her from the water. Iri and Jiqui fanned her dry, while Doria brushed her hair until it fell like a river of liquid silver down her back. They scented her with spice flour and cinnamon, a touch on each wrist, behind her ears, on the tips of her milk-heavy breasts. The last dab was for her sex. Iri's finger felt as light and cool as a lover's kiss as it slid softly up between her lips. Afterward, Danny sent them all away, so she might prepare Khal Drogo for his final ride into the Nightlands. She washed his body clean and brushed and oiled his hair, running her fingers through it for the last time, feeling the weight of it, remembering the first time she had touched it, the night of their wedding ride. His hair had never been cut. How many men could die with their hair uncut? She buried her face in it and inhaled the dark fragrance of the oils. He smelled like grass and warm earth, like smoke and semen and horses. He smelled like Drogo. "Forgive me, son of my life," she thought. "Forgive me for all I have done and all I must do. I paid the price, my star, but it was too high, too high." Danny braided his hair and slid the silver rings onto his moustache and hung the bells one by one. So many bells, gold and silver and bronze, bells so his enemies would hear him coming and grow weak with fear. She dressed him in horsehair leggings and high boots, buckling a belt heavy with gold and silver medallions about his waist. Over his scarred chest, she slipped a painted vest, old and faded, the one Drogo had loved best. For herself, she chose loose sand-silk trousers, sandals that laced halfway up her legs, and a vest like Drogo's. The sun was going down when she called them back to carry the body to the pyre. The Dothraki watched in silence as Jogo and Ego bore him from the tent. Danny walked behind them. They laid him down on his cushions and silks, his head towards the Mother of Mountains far to the northeast. "Oil," she commanded, and they brought forth the jars and poured them over the pyre, soaking the silks and the brush and the bundles of dried grass, until the oil trickled from beneath the logs and the air was rich with fragrance. "Bring my eggs," Danny commanded her handmaids. Something in her voice made them run. Ser Jorah took her arm. "My queen, Drogo will have no use for dragon's eggs in the Nightlands. Better to sell them in a Ashayi. Sell one, and we can buy a ship to take us back to the free cities. Sell all three, and you'll be a wealthy woman all your days."
"They were not given to me to sell," Danny told him. She climbed the pyre herself to place the eggs around her sun and stars, the black beside his heart, under his arm, the green beside his head, his braid coiled around it, the cream and gold down between his legs. When she kissed him for the last time, Danny could taste the sweetness of the oil on his lips. As she climbed down off the pyre, she noticed Miramaz Dur watching her.
"You are mad,"
the god's wife said hoarsely. "Is it so far from madness to wisdom?" Danny asked. "Ser Jorah, take this Meiji and bind her to the pyre."
To the... "My queen, no, hear me.
Do as I say." Still he hesitated until her anger flared. "You swore to obey me, whatever might come. Rakaro, help him." The god's wife did not cry out as they dragged her to Khal Drogo's pyre and staked her down amidst his treasures. Danny poured the oil over the woman's head herself. "I thank you, Miramazdur," she said, "for the lessons you have taught me."
"You will not hear me scream,"
Mira responded, as the oil dripped from her hair and soaked her clothing. "I will," Danny said, "but it's not your screams I want, only your life. I remember what you told me. Only death can pay for life." Miramazdur opened her mouth, but made no reply. As she stepped away, Danny saw that the contempt was gone from the mage's flat black eyes. In its place was something that might have been fear. Then there was nothing to be done but watch the sun and look for the first star. When a horse lord dies, his horse is slain with him, so he might ride proud into the Nightlands. The bodies are burned beneath the open sky, and the carl rises on his fiery steed to take his place among the stars. The more fiercely the man burned in life, the brighter his star will shine in the darkness. Jogo spied it first. "There!" he said, in a hushed voice. Danny looked and saw it, low in the east. The first star was a comet, burning red, blood red, fire red, the dragon's tail. She could not have asked for a stronger sign. Danny took the torch from Aegir's hand and thrust it between the logs. The oil took the fire at once, the brush and dried grass a heartbeat later. Tiny flames went darting up the wood like swift red mice, skating over the oil and leaping from bark to branch to leaf. A rising heat puffed at her face, soft and sudden as a lover's breath, but in seconds it had grown too hot to bear. Danny stepped backward. The wood crackled louder and louder. Miramazdur began to sing in a shrill, ululating voice. The flames whirled and writhed, racing each other up the platform. The dusk shimmered as the air itself seemed to liquefy from the heat. Danny heard lugs split and crack. The fires swept over Miramazdur. Her song grew louder, shriller. Then she gasped again and again, and her song became a shuddering wail, thin and high and full of agony. And now the flames reached her Drogo, and now they were all around him. His clothing took fire, and for an instant the carl was clad in wisps of floating orange silk and tendrils of curling smoke, grey and greasy. Danny's lips parted, and she found herself holding her breath. Part of her wanted to go to him, as Ser Jorah had feared, to rush into the flames, to beg for his forgiveness, and take him inside her one last time, the fire melting the flesh from their bones until they were as one forever. She could smell the odor of burning flesh, no different from horse flesh roasting in a fire pit. The pyre roared in the deepening dusk like some great beast, drowning out the fainter sounds of Miramazdur's screaming, and sending up long tongues of flame to lick at the belly of the night. As the smoke grew thicker, the Dothraki backed away, coughing. Huge orange gouts of fire unfurled their banners in that hellish wind, the logs hissing and cracking, glowing cinders rising on the smoke to float away into the dark like so many newborn fireflies. The heat beat at the air with great red wings, driving the Dothraki back, driving off even Mormont. But Danny stood her ground. She was the blood of the dragon, and the fire was in her. She had sensed the truth of it long ago, Danny thought, as she took a step closer to the conflagration, but the brazier had not been hot enough. The flames writhed before her like the women who had danced at her wedding, whirling and singing and spinning their yellow and orange and crimson veils, fearsome to behold, yet lovely, so lovely, alive with heat. Danny opened her arms to them, her skin flushed and glowing. "This is a wedding too," she thought. Miramazdur
had fallen silent. The guard's wife thought her a child. But children grow, and children learn. Another step, and Danny could feel the heat of the sand on the soles of her feet, even through her sandals. Sweat ran down her thighs and between her breasts, and in rivulets over her cheeks, where tears had once run. Sir Jorah was shouting behind her, but he did not matter any more. Only the fire mattered. The flames were so beautiful, the loveliest thing she had ever seen, each one a sorcerer robed in yellow and orange and scarlet, swirling long, smoky cloaks. She saw crimson fire lions and great yellow serpents and unicorns made of pale blue flame. She saw fish and foxes and monsters, wolves and bright birds and flowering trees, each more beautiful than the last. She saw a horse, a great grey stallion, limned in smoke, its flowing mane a nimbus of blue flame. "Yes, my love, my sun and stars, yes, mount now, ride now." Her vest had begun to smoulder, so Danny shrugged it off and let it fall to the ground. The painted leather burst into sudden flame as she skipped closer to the fire, her breast bare to the blaze, streams of milk flowing from her red and swollen nipples. "Now," she thought, "now." And for an instant, she glimpsed Khal Drogo before her, mounted on his smoky stallion, a flaming lash in his hand. He smiled, and the whip snaked down at the pyre, hissing. She heard a crack, a sound of shattering stone. The platform of wood and brush and grass began to shift and collapse in upon itself. Bits of burning wood slid down at her. Danny was showered with ash and cinders, and something else came crashing down, bouncing and rolling to land at her feet. A chunk of curved rock, pale and veined with gold, broken and smoking. The roaring filled the world. Yet dimly through the firefall, Danny heard women shriek, and children cry out in wonder. Only death can pay for life. And there came a second crack, loud and sharp as thunder, and the smoke stirred and whirled around her, and the pyre shifted, the logs exploding as the fire touched their secret hearts. She heard the screams of frightened horses, and the voices of the Dothraki raised in shouts of fear and terror, and Sir Jorah calling her name and cursing. "No," she wanted to shout to him. "No, my good knight, do not fear for me. The fire is mine. I am Daenerys Stormborn, daughter of dragons, bride of dragons, mother of dragons. Don't you see? Don't you see?" With a belch of flame and smoke that reached 30 feet into the sky, the pyre collapsed and came down around her. Unafraid, Danny stepped forward into the firestorm, calling to her children. The third crack was as loud and sharp as the breaking of the world. When the fire died at last, and the ground became cool enough to walk upon, Sir Jorah Mormont found her, amidst the ashes, surrounded by blackened logs and bits of glowing ember and the burnt bones of man and woman and stallion. She was naked, covered with soot, her clothes turned to ash, her beautiful hair all crisped away. Yet she was unhurt. The cream and gold dragon was suckling at her left breast, the green and bronze at the right. Her arms cradled them close. The black and scarlet beast was draped across her shoulders, its long, sinuous neck coiled under her chin. When it saw Jorah, it raised its head and looked at him with eyes as red as coals. Wordless, the knight fell to his knees. The men of her cars
came up behind him. Jogo was the first to lay his arrack at her feet. "Blood of my blood," he murmured, pushing his face to the smoking earth.
"Blood of my blood,"
she heard Ego echo.
"Blood of my blood," Rakaro shouted.
And after them came a handmaids, and then the others. All the Dothraki men and women and children. And Danny had only to look at their eyes to know that they were hers. Now, today, and tomorrow, and forever. Hers, as they had never been Drogo's. As Daenerys Targaryen rose to her feet, her black hissed, pale smoke venting from its mouth and nostrils. The other two pulled away from her breasts and added their voices to the call, translucent wings unfolding and stirring the air. And for the first time, in hundreds of years, the night came alive with the music of dragons. This is Roy Dotrice. We hope you've enjoyed this production of A Game of Thrones, A Song of Fire and Ice, Book One, by George R. R. Martin. To find out more about the complete Books on Tape catalogue of unabridged audiobooks, call our customer service department at the number on this package, or visit us online at booksontape.com.